Hello, I'm Rebecca Robinson, your host for the More to Life podcast in West Kelowna. Stories of people's lives have always fascinated me, and I believe they're one of the best gifts we can give. Our testimonies on how God delivers us through challenges or dark places inevitably gives hope and can help others see a light at the end of their tunnel. Join me as I interview varied guests who bravely tell their stories for us to be encouraged by. Welcome back to the podcast, More to Life, here at Emmanuel Church in West Kelowna. I'm Rebecca, and I'm sitting here today, and I get to interview Nathan Bergen, who has been at Emmanuel for...
3 years.
3 years now.
This Easter marks 3 years.
Oh, that's a nice beginning that you had.
It was also my baptism date.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Sorry, I almost got choked up there right off the bat.
And that's okay.
No, it's not.
Well, maybe it'll happen later.
No, we're good.
So we have a excellent conversation ahead of us. And from the list of this man's life that I have looked at, he is a survivor. Mm. And he is probably the most resilient person I'm going to meet to be able to get through the things that I'm reading right now on this life testimony. So I want to jump right into it. Your first item on your list says cruddy childhood. How would you describe some events from then?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I have no idea. Like, I honestly don't remember what's on there. So some of the stuff is probably going to come to a surprise to me that I put it down, because when Margo sends this, I just went, oh, okay. Just blurb it down.
Yeah.
Cruddy childhood. It wasn't all bad, but how do I put this? So it took a very long time sort of to figure out sort of what was wrong with me. Hmm. And it was ADD. So a lot of that, I had no coping mechanisms as a child.
Right.
My home life was verbally, aggressively violent.
Okay.
My parents would like argue nonstop for many, many years. And I guess it's safe to say that I would, you know, back in the 70s, you wanted to get out of your house. Nobody wanted to stay in their home. And so getting out of the house, you know, I would literally camp overnight somewhere in our neighborhood just to get out of the house, just because I knew the old man was going to be screaming and yelling.
Right.
So, and that had a lot of interpersonal interactions that were almost always negative with other people.
Okay.
And like compiling that with like the ADD, I think it's safe to say I just wasn't a very likable person. Hmm. And it was because I just sort of blurt things out.
Right.
That, I mean, I get
no
you.
Filter.
Oh, here it is. Oh, I didn't even know what a filter was. first season of The Office. Have you ever seen it?
No, sorry.
Okay. I would be Steve Carell's character.
Okay, well, I know
as
him.
As a child.
Yeah.
He would say the most awkward stuff that you could possibly imagine. And like you're just sitting there going, ugh, you know.
Painful.
Cringe.
Yeah.
But all of that stuff was somewhat manageable because of the athletics.
Okay, yeah, that's
baseball,
next we have here.
Yeah, baseball, football, hockey, and then later a lot of skiing, a lot of downhill skiing.
Was all your family active? Did you have siblings?
No, I had a sister. We don't speak.
Okay.
And I think it's safe to say that my relationship with my sister mirrored the relationship my father had with his wife, my mother, in terms of verbal violence.
Mm-hmm.
My sister would say and do things that, like, just devastated me emotionally. Mm. And I would be, like, screaming at her.
Mm. Was she older, younger?
No, 2 years older.
Yeah, okay.
But she's tiny. She's like you. Mm-hmm. Like, and a guy, like I've been this height since I think 11 or 12.
Oh, wow.
I was always the biggest kid on the field, on mm-hmm. the pitch, except for football. I mean, there's some big boys even nowadays.
Yeah.
But if it wasn't for the athletics, I don't know what I would have done. Because part of the ADD, I think there's also a little bit of spectrum in there as well. Because I used to do this thing as a child, and I only recently Googled it because it's like it's still bothering me. And I never thought to until recently. I used to thump my head on my pillow as a child.
Oh, yeah.
That's well, patience. Apparently it's fairly common.
Yeah, yeah.
But it goes away in a year or two. Well, I did mine into my teenage years. But that's how it, literally how I put myself to sleep.
Yeah.
It's almost like you don't feel gravity. Like you don't, and that's why, I mean, when you see space movies, it spins, right? So you can get a sense of gravity. And the way I just kind of put things together is I would thump my head because it was like the most uncomfortable thing to just sit there and try and go to sleep. So all of that sort of just in that, that spectrum part and that sort of lack of feeling gravity part. And I'm not saying that's what it is. It just kind of makes sense. Like you just kind of, you're spatially unaware. I think it's, I don't know if that makes any sense. Anyway, but it's what allowed me to exceed in sports because I would throw myself to hit people, not physically, like body hit. Like in football, I was an outside linebacker. Baseball, I was a back catcher. So I always got to tackle the guy coming
running from third base.
Oh, yeah. Come on in, buddy. I'll take you. Plus, I was a big guy, too. So it's kind of like you're not getting past me. and, you know, hockey, I probably had more charging penalties than anyone.
Well, I guess the bonus that your parents believed in, that would be such a help for you to put you in all those sports.
It was my father, not my mother. My mother did not want me to be in sports.
Okay.
And herein lies part of the problem. She had my father do or convince him for a soft compromise.
Okay.
I want you to keep in mind, it's 1977, 1978. Pretty macho era. And the compromise was that I had to join the school choir.
Oh. Well, with your baritone, she probably recognized that.
I was a soprano. Or an alto, sorry.
Back then, okay.
They actually had me tested. I had a 3-octave range.
Wow.
Yeah. I was a pretty good singer. But I would go out of my way to destroy my voice because it's the 70s. And then to add insult to injury, Mrs. Wheaton, she's resting with the Lord now for sure. She had us wear capes.
Oh. I can almost see it. 1970s, maybe mustard yellow.
Also picture a guy that I was that kid that had that little rooster tail, like the little cowlick I could never flatten it. So one day I just got sick and tired of it and I just cut it.
Yeah.
And it made it worse.
Yeah.
Because everybody could see.
All right. Yeah. So high school, it looks like did you finish early? Because it says you've joined the Army Reserves at 17 years old.
Yeah.
Wow.
I actually dropped out in grade 11 year. Play hockey.
Oh, okay.
And it's just Army Reserve. You only go away for the weekends, like 1 weekend a month.
Oh, okay.
2 nights a week. And it was arguably the best time of my life. Lots of 17 years old and you get to blow stuff up on the weekends. You get to fire all the machine guns. Like we were a light armored reconnaissance unit.
Right.
So we got to play with the big ones, like the big 50 cals that you see in all the movies.
Yeah.
The 30 cals that you see in all the World War II movies. Because we're still 1980s Canadian forces. So of course, our new equipment is from 1942.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy.
Antiquated. I was probably, I think it's safe to say, and I just mean it like sort of jokingly, but the helmets we used to wear were probably surplus from Vietnam. In my life, it didn't matter what, I'd always felt a nerd, a need to serve. And I thought, back then, the service meant in the course of like serving your country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so colloquial. Mm-hmm. Like, thank you for serving your country. Well, right. Did I? No. I mean, I did, but no. Showing up.
You could have if there was an issue.
Oh, I would have.
Mm-hmm.
Those opportunities came up in the early 90s
mm-hmm.
with Yugoslavia,
mm-hmm.
right? Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of my reality to all that changed when I knew a few guys that went over in the first rotation in 92. One of them, I was always tempted to say two, but I don't think it was two. One of them took his own life within weeks
wow.
of coming home.
Wow.
So
in that time period,
mm-hmm.
Like how long were you in the Army Reserves?
6 years.
6 years. Yeah. Okay. And so then you, did you ever have any kind of sense of faith or upbringing? No. It was all strictly atheist.
I think the best way to put it, I was very uncomfortable with the concept of God.
Okay.
Like almost a cognitive dissonance.
How come, do you think?
I have no idea. It was something I could never put my finger on.
Hmm.
But I did not feel like I belonged inside of a church.
Right.
And we're not talking like Emmanuel. Like, we're talking like Anglicans and Catholics.
Right.
Like that yep. smell. Like I've been to a church as a kid, and it's like old lady perfume or something. Like
yeah.
it's just got that. Every church smells the same. Well, for the most part.
But there was no like
no.
your parents didn't regularly go or seek
no.
it or grandparents.
Oh
or?
No! Well, my nana was Anglican.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so then you mentened your 20s. What happened in your 20s? You hit some struggles and some clinical depression you wrote down.
A lot of promiscuity.
Okay.
A lot of, you know, I was fit. Mm-hmm. I had the arms, had the chest, had the abs. My ab game was pretty strong. sorry. Gosh. But it was all...
Would you say you were looking for something? You were looking for adventure?
I had no idea what I was looking for. So in all that, like from, I'd say in the first 20 years, because of like sort of the ADD and possible spectrum stuff, I had a very different way of looking at people. And I only discovered this recently, is that I didn't look at people as people so much as I looked at them as their roles.
Hmm.
And it prevented me from getting to know people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would, you're a principal. Oh, I'm dismissing you. What could you possibly know about hockey?
Right.
You're a hockey coach. I'm dismissing you. What could you possibly know about mechanics?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense, but no. I only discovered that like maybe in the last month or two.
Hmm.
And it was sort of an aha moment. I like to think that I'm very self-reflective. And it used to be a very critical form of self-reflection. That sort of, I'm my own worst enemy, had a whole new definition of me.
Mm-hmm.
I was just my worst enemy. I would like abuse myself with how I was living my life.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Drinking drugs were never part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like, my fellow alcoholics will know exactly what I'm saying. Like, I could drink like everybody else back then. You know, I could have one or two beers, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Would I go out and tie one on with the boys? Absolutely. Of course, I didn't have a lot of boys to hang out with, but I could still go. But those, looking back at it, how I would view people, like I got married initially very early in life. I was married at, I think, 25 or 26.
Mm-hmm.
Like quite a while ago, but still. And my marriage, oh my gosh, I ran kicking and screaming within months.
Oh, wow. Not the right time in your life.
Or the right woman.
Okay.
The woman at the time that I thought I was marrying was very... self-sufficient, mm-hmm. right? But when we got married, I would literally wake up and my clothes would be put at the foot of the bed for me. My lunch was in a brown paper bag on the counter. And my dinner was waiting for me when I got home. Mm-hmm. I know there's people out there listening going, how did you have it so bad?
Poor you.
Right? But it freaked me out to know, because she'd never done that. We've been together for a few years, but she had never once. Oh, she makes dinner all the time. But this was deliberate. My supper was on the table when I got home. I waited, washed my hands, mm-hmm. cold beer, mm-hmm. and my dinner was waiting for me.
And so what was the problem?
It scared the crap out of me. Hmm. I have no idea why.
Was that actually, no, I do know why. Image of like something you weren't ready for.
Again, I didn't. Like, if I put the filter on it of looking at people only as their roles rather than who they are as a person, my takeaway from that now that I'm looking at that would be, I didn't see this woman as a wife. I saw her as a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And that I really did not take the time to get to know her. She was a girlfriend. Mm.
And that was a role that she felt she needed to... Yeah. Excel.
Yeah.
Off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah. She should have been doing that from word one or day one, so I knew I was getting myself into. Because I'm not comfortable with people doing things for me at all. Hmm. Like, I mean, at all. Like, you can't. If somebody does something nice for me,
you feel really awkward.
No, I feel like, what the hell do you want from me?
Oh, okay. Like, you owe them.
Yeah.
You might have to owe somebody.
Well, that comes from my father, because every time my father did something for me, he would literally say, you owe me.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. My father is not, I'm going to say this, like, I doubt he'll ever hear this, but even if he would, I'm okay saying this because I've said it to his face. I'm not talking smack. I don't talk smack about people behind their back. Mm. If I won't say it to your face, then I won't say it away from you. Mm-hmm. My father's not a very nice man, but there's solid reasons. And again, those reasons, I only came to learn within the last few years. Mm-hmm. And I don't know all the details, but if there's anybody out there that has a right to be angry at the world, it's him. Hmm. Has he done anything with it? Nope.
Hmm. It's all pent up.
Yep.
Yeah.
He is a very angry person. Hmm. And I mean, it takes nothing to set him off.
Hmm. That's sad.
Yeah.
So what do you think sparked your major clinical depression? What was the, what was a turning point that began that?
Well, my divorce.
Okay.
My divorce, I think, kicked it off.
And so how long was this period in your life?
Oh, years.
What happened?
I was driving a long-haul truck, like long-haul truck driving. I hated every minute of it.
Oh.
But it, I think it's safe to say that I was constantly running, but I was running for myself. Mm-hmm. And one of my most favorite expressions is, no matter where I run, there I am, right? Mm-hmm. But it also, driving the truck, also gave me the ability to provide. Because I didn't see myself as a dad. I saw myself as a provider. That's your job. That's your role. Mm. But I loved every, my son, oh, what a beautiful kid. Like he, oh, anyway. And it literally broke my heart every time I had to go back on the road. Mm-hmm. And his mother and I were never anything serious. Her pregnancy would be considered accidental. Mm-hmm. But I really did love being a dad.
Yeah.
But I wasn't, I think it's better. I think it's easier. The better way to say that. I was a really good father. I wasn't a very good dad.
So was this your second marriage?
Yeah. No, this was friends gotcha. With benefits. FW. Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay.
I live a pretty PG life now, like, unless I'm at work. Oh my gosh, those guys. Anyway.
So are you still truck driving?
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh heck no. Oh, not the isolation right. is the killer. There was a lot of screaming behind the wheel. Hmm. At the frustration of the isolation. Mm-hmm. But it was almost like I was, I don't know if it's safe to say I was deliberately doing it to myself, because I had a lot of self-loathing in there. Hmm. And I didn't see myself as anything more than a wallet.
Right.
For my son's mother.
Right.
And that was a role that she would push harder and harder as my son got older.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever heard the term parental alienation.
I have.
Mm-hmm. At one point, I think I would, arrogantly or not, I would consider myself, years ago, I would have been a self-taught expert on the symptoms of parental alienation.
Hmm.
And as bad as I felt for, and the difficult part for a parent who has a child who's a victim of parental alienation, the hardest part is not getting lost in your own self-pity, right? Or your own feelings. Because it's like, there was, I think, a judge in Southern Ontario that basically came out and said that this is almost, mentally wise, almost worse than sexual abuse. Hmm. Like, it's that high on the list, because you're taking a child who just inherently loves their mom or their dad.
Mm-hmm.
And they're being told that this person is a horrible human being.
Hmm.
And not, there's nothing to, I think, mentally justify it in that child's mind, which is where the abuse comes in.
Mm-hmm. So there was no experience between you and your son very much if you were away for so long. He couldn't develop the kind of relationship with you.
Well, I stopped working on the highway in 2001.
Okay.
In 2002, I would begin the big money portion of my life for a working guy.
Mm-hmm.
A long-haul truck driver, I was making, my best year would have been $65,000.
Mm-hmm.
My first year in the oil patch, that's what I paid in taxes.
Yeah.
Right.
That's, I've heard, yeah.
Yeah.
Big and time.
Even now, you know, I'm not rich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I still owe a lot of money. But even by today's standards, back then, that was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're talking $250 plus.
Wow.
That's all overtime.
Wow.
Right. And
that's wild.
No monetary maturity to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
Very fiscally irresponsible.
So talk about after, you know, I don't know what this point in time was, 2007, was that kind of a key turning point? You witnessed a car collision.
Yeah. Three, actually.
Three.
Yeah. July 4th, September 6th. November 6th.
How bizarre. Were you in the car?
No.
Or just witnessed?
Witnessed all. The one in September happened right in front of me.
Hmm.
Wow. And it was a literal nightmare playing out in real time.
Hmm.
And it was, and you know, I don't talk about that night ever. But I was reflecting on it before here.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I will never, there are two sounds from that night that I will never forget. How quiet it was. And I could hear the flames. Like there was one vehicle fully engulfed.
Wow.
People inside.
Mm.
And you could just, it was like, there was no ambient sound other than the flames.
Mm.
It was creepy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second sound of that night, like when the police, fire, and ambulance showed up, one of the things I learned about emergency scene management is everybody stays busy. There's nobody standing around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because you're not earning your money. It's because everybody that's out there that's in those uniforms knows how this night's going to play out.
Yeah.
Mentally.
Yeah.
And there was, one of the people had been ejected from the car. I actually tripped over his body. I didn't see him when I was on the phone with 911.
Wow.
It was creepy. And his body was contorted.
Mm-hmm.
Right? His arm was above his head,
mm-hmm.
but in not a natural position.
Right.
So the paramedics came, they rip open his chest and they set up the AED. And they said, "Are you comfortable bagging him?" And I went, "Yeah, I think so." Like, they want me. Like, because I'm the one that saw this. I'm the one that phoned 911. They're even keeping me busy.
Really? Wow.
And a bag is just that big thing you see on the ambulance or medical shows, and it's got a little face piece over it.
Okay.
And you just, it's like, it, the bag is about the same size as a full lung.
Oh, right? I see. Okay.
And you squeeze it. You just gently squeeze this
like
thing.
Like a lung, yep.
I must have taken a dozen first aid classes at that point in my life. Even in Vance, I was a what they call an OFA3, which is like any paramedical know this joke. How do you know who the new medic in the room is? Don't worry, they'll tell you. Oh. I was an OFA3. Like I was top
right. Yeah, yeah.
But when I went to bag him, I didn't tilt his head back, so his airway was closed off.
Oh.
And when I squeezed it, there was a...
Right.
And it was almost exactly like that.
Hmm.
Because the cheeks just started flooding. It couldn't go anywhere,
yeah.
Yeah, there was nowhere for them to go. And it was just that sound of the... I'll never forget. Like, mm-hmm. That is...
So what happened observing all this?
Oh, sorry, yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm getting lost in sort of the...
That's so okay.
There was a vehicle traveling south, and anybody that's been in...
I mean, more like what happened to you? Like what?
Oh,
as a after effect of all of this, you mentioned PTSD. And
yeah, it took a while for that to sink in.
Okay.
Everything that you've ever been told about PTSD is—it's one of those things that people are always like, just get over it. And
how did you know you even had it?
I didn't. Okay. That was the thing.
Yeah.
It was pointed out to me.
Oh, okay.
The next morning, well, that night, the lady I was dating at the time, well, we were living together, I was living in Fort McMurray at the time,
mm-hmm.
and her daughter was 17 or 18 at the time. And in this whole nightmare mess, I wound up phoning her. And I told her exactly what happened. That this young girl, she was literally cut in half at the waist, and then she burned. There was nothing recognizable. And I told, well, let's just call her my stepdaughter for lack of a better term. I told my stepdaughter all the details. And I said to her, this is why your mother and I need to know where you are. Because I wasn't even close to being a Christian. But as I was walking up to the vehicle that was on fire, all I could mutter out of my mouth was, God, please help them. God, please help them. And you'd think you'd want to pray. Like I know now that a lot more would come out of my mouth for the Lord other than, God, please help them.
Hmm.
But when I, like, the vehicle wasn't so involved that I couldn't approach it, and I could see, not knowing what had taken place to this young woman. It was a passenger side impact.
Mm-hmm.
So her end of the vehicle... drove it into her waist, and when I went to pull her out, there was a thud.
Hmm.
I liken it to like cracking your neck type thud. And it became very clear she's not coming out. And I didn't see the driver.
Hmm.
His seat would broke into a reclined position.
Okay.
And he was on fire.
And so you were right up at the car trying to get them out. And...
Well, there were so many nightmare scenarios that night because as I was leaving the vehicle, I'm on the phone with 911 at this point, and I was walking away from the vehicle. I uttered the words, if there's anybody left in there, there's no chance they're alive. That's mm-hmm. how involved the vehicle was.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before all the fire. An ambulance showed up, and I'd forgotten one of the most basic tenets of crisis. Like in those types of situations that we were taught in the military, you don't stop. You don't assume they're dead. And even if they are, you still go get them. And I did not do that. And that's where a lot of the self-blame came in. Because as I was walking away, I'm looking at this lady she was in her vehicle, her window was rolled down, and she started this blood-curdling scream.
Oh, goodness.
The driver's door opened up, the driver got out, and he was on fire.
Mm-hmm.
Just up his back.
Wow.
And we would later learn this is not possible for him to do that because both his femurs were shattered.
What?
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say shattered, but they were solidly broken.
Right. Yeah.
His parents are believers.
Okay. Wow. That's incredible.
Well, here's the most incredible part of the whole night. And it was the part that really messed me up. When the Mounties came up to me, a lot of times Mounties come off like jerks. Mm-hmm. Like, and I get it. My sister is a retired cop, so I get it. I get why they're jerks. I don't like it, especially when it's towards me, but I get it. I was sitting in the passenger seat, and he's like, okay, I just want you to know, like, we can sit here all night, and you just take your time. Hmm. And I was kind of like, wow. And I tried uttering what I had seen, and I couldn't. I said to him, you know what? I said, I'm not there. I said, mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm not there.
Hmm.
I would go home. I had half a bottle of wine. I wasn't drinking yet, but I had a half bottle of wine to steady the nerves. I woke up, no sense of emotion whatsoever, but within 5 seconds, I was sobbing uncontrollably, and I had no idea why.
Wow.
Like, I wasn't thinking about anything. I was just
overwhelmed, overcome.
Something, yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's like our body has to react somehow to what we've seen. Even though our mind hasn't processed any of it yet, our body still has to get out some form of release or emotion, right?
Yeah. I had made an arrangement the night before to go to the Morinville detachment, the RCMP. This happened in a little tiny hamlet called Legal, Alberta. It's like mm-hmm. Highway 2 north of Edmonton. And I go into the detachment. It's a sort of standard interview room that you would see on any of your crime shows. And my phone rang. And it was my stepdaughter. Well, she never calls me. And she was crying.
Oh, no.
And I thought, oh, my gosh, I told her too much. You know, she's a pretty tough kid. Sorry.
It's okay.
I didn't think this would happen, but I had told her.
Just take a break.
I told her how her best friend died.
Hmm.
It was her best friend that was in the car.
Oh my gosh, and you had no idea.
None.
What are the chances of that?
Only me.
Oh my goodness. And she didn't find out until the next day that that was her friend.
Renee.
Oh, that's crushing.
Sorry.
Oh, that's goodness here.
As a Christian now, her parents are us. They're fully walking with the Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the comfort I have now.
Mm.
I remember her dad has cerebral palsy.
Wow.
So he uses those walkers.
Yeah.
And he's up at the front row. The church was beyond packed. And I'm sitting at the back, literally struggling not to pass out.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw his hands just up, praising the Lord. Like, like what a difficult... Like, as Christians, okay, she is, like, seriously in a better place.
Yeah. And had you known that about them before?
No.
Wow.
I didn't know that till that day.
Yeah.
They know I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse, the young man who was driving, I wound up having dinner with his parents on the one-year anniversary. They're solid believing Christians. Like, they're really good people.
Mm.
But we lost contact, probably more for me. Like, I wasn't able to reconcile any of it. Like, the other two accidents, I wasn't involved. Like, I witnessed, but wasn't, there was already.
So what direction did your life take now after that? I mean, you said you hadn't been drinking yet.
Way for the worst. Like, yeah, I was never a drinker. But the worst part of PTSD, and what I learned later, is that PTSD is when the two spheres of the brain stop communicating. There's a left and right side to your brain, and there's no communication. And how I started, like, at the time, I didn't know anything was happening, but people always say, dude, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, why? And they're like, your eyes are going in different direction.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I heard that on at least a few times a week. Sleep was not really happening. So I became dependent on these little blue sleeping pills. And then it's those, apparently those blue sleeping pills are in the same chemical level as a benzodiazepine, like same sort of thing. Your body will develop tolerance.
Okay.
And I read on the side of the bottle one night, alcohol may intensify effects. Perfect.
Oh, okay.
Off to the liquor store I go, grab a good bottle of wine, because I'm cultured, right? Only the unwashed masses drink beer. Well, I mean, I shouldn't say that. Like, that's not how I saw it. But,
So this was your coping, your escape, your way to make it.
Well, I had absolutely no idea how to cope.
No.
Basically, the thing with PTSD are the intrusive thoughts. It's basically your brain forcing a memory, and there's no holding off on it. It's now, right? I would have horrible nightmares. This took all a few years to totally sink in. And then by 2010, I didn't know it at the time, but apparently I tried to kill myself. I took all those blue sleeping pills one night.
Oh, dear.
And that's not a good thing.
But you were already under the influence of alcohol.
Yeah. So when you take those pills, you don't know. Like, you and I could be talking right now, and I would have no memory of it the next day. I think down in the States, they call it Ambien. Up here, it's Zopiclone, and I just call it Zombiclone. Because you're...
Basically, that
is. You're a literal zombie. So yeah. I had actually had a roommate. I put an ad up for a roommate. There was a lady. She was a Christian. And she was on her way to work. And I was drinking. I was like, at this particular point, I would drink a lot, but it wasn't every day. Like, I could go.
And this was in Fort?
No, I'm living. By this time, I moved out of Fort McMurray after the accident happened. In 2009, I bought my house in Edmonton.
Okay.
So I put out, I was house broke, so I put out an advert for this lady answers. Anyways, she's on her way to work one day. I was drinking my face off, and she said the Lord told her to turn around and go home.
Wow.
And she did. And apparently, like, I have no memory of any of this. I was gray skin and blue lips. Paramedics got there, and they had to jumpstart my heart. And when I was in the hospital, again, no memory of it, apparently I repeatedly told the paramedics to just let me die.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How old were you at this point?
40. No coping mechanisms. That was Christmas of 2010. So this is kind of, 2010 is kind of like peak mental, not keeping it together.
Yeah.
Like, I keep it together at work.
Yeah.
For as long as I could. And then when I would go home, it would be instantly bottle of wine. And then 2011, things between my son's mother and I are like in an all-time low, and that's saying something. And then Christmas of 2011 was when I would lose my younger stepbrother.
Oh.
Anyone who's ever lost anyone to suicide, I don't know if it's the same for them, but I was, in one moment, I was both amazingly devastated and amazingly in a state of rage.
So many more challenges that mm-hmm. I'm reading about. Your mother's health declining, mm-hmm. your niece lost her life in a car wreck, mm-hmm. another brother committed mm-hmm. suicide, your grandfather passed away, mm-hmm. a massive Canada Revenue bill.
$250,000.
Yeah. I mean, all of these things adding up, and yet people are going to be amazed, and I think at this point want to know what turned everything around for you. What was the catalyst here? You were at what? I mean, rock bottom for you. It seems like happened so many times.
Rock bottom.
Over.
We're not even close to rock bottom. in all that stuff, yeah. I don't want to spend a lot of time there because I thought the whole car crash thing was. But yeah, so 2016, not a good year. My cousin's daughter was killed in a horrible accident mm-hmm. in Thailand. Mm-hmm. June, my older stepbrother went missing mm-hmm. very publicly in the Castlegar area. And then 4 days after he was declared missing, they found his body at the end of a logging road. Mm. Yeah. So he had taken his life too. Mm. And then October, my grandfather would pass away. Mom came out at Christmas time that year, 16. And I had no idea. I mean, I knew her health wasn't great. Mm-hmm. I didn't know how bad it was.
What was your, you said here, 2018 was your very first admission to the hospital.
Yeah. I went from drinking steadily every day to binge drinking. Mm-hmm. I would start off with a 26er a day, and I would work myself into a 60.
Wow.
I wouldn't finish all the 60, but I come pretty close.
It's toxic.
That's, oh yeah.
Yeah.
I would have entered ICU twice, on life support twice for a few days. The blood alcohol, 0.40 and 0.44. 0.4 is supposed to be lethal.
Wow.
My body had built up such a tolerance. Well, to that point, you know, no more tolerance, but I would drink myself until my body would physically reject the alcohol. Like I could not get any more alcohol in me, and therefore the withdrawals would start mm-hmm. almost instantly. Mm. And alcoholic withdrawal, I can't speak to anything. I've never been addicted to anything else. Alcohol withdrawal is like a truly horrible physical experience.
Yeah. That itself generally can cause death as well.
It's actually the most dangerous drug to detox off.
Yeah.
It's the only one that can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called a syncopated seizure. Hmm. And it just stops your heart.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. My memory from 2018 till now is pretty fuzzy. Mm-hmm. Like I don't remember a lot. I do remember going to the hospital, mm-hmm. having to call the ambulance because my body would start just uncontrollably shaking.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was two instances where I don't know if the hospital staff thought I was going to live
mm-hmm.
because I had like pretty bad pancreatitis.
Mm.
I was hospitalized for 2 or 3 weeks on both occasions, and they had, again, fuzzy memory. I was on these, I had like 3 or 4 IV bags,
mm-hmm.
no idea what's in them. Can't keep, like my diet consisted of broth and Jell-O
mm-hmm.
the entire time, like nothing solid.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think I would go into rehab. My first stint in rehab would have been 2019. And I had no idea what to expect. Like my family, so I went into like, it's like a sober living house type rehab.
Okay.
Mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like one step removed from jail in terms of the people that you're housed with.
Hmm.
Most, like I was the only alcoholic in there, and everybody else was either just released from jail or prison, or awaiting trial or sentencing.
Wow. So after rehab, then...
Oh, yeah, this is when the good news starts.
Okay, let's get to the good news.
Yeah, oh, this is the best part. Okay, so I'm nearing the end of rehab, and my, I gotta word this carefully because my cousin and her son, my nephew, yes, Zach, you're my nephew. Those two notwithstanding, my sister, my father and his wife, I was persona non grata. Mm-hmm. And I was enraged with my sister because what meager possessions I had left, she saw fit to throw in the garbage. And there was sentimental stuff. Like, I'm sorry, my sister is not a nice person. And I don't know what fuels her anger towards me. But the really good news is that I had spent my first Christmas away and in a rehab facility. I wasn't welcome at home. Okay. Oh my gosh, when did I have that feeling? It would have been, so I moved here, this is 3 years. I moved here in 21 into 22. And several months before then, I forgot to, like, this is when the good news starts. I was sitting in my house in Edmonton after another bender. Just sitting in my chair, blank TV. I was just staring at this empty TV. And I had this sensation. I don't know if it's flow through me, around me, or what. But I had, it lasted maybe as long as a breath. The message was, you are safe. And it was with a feeling. And that feeling was not for anything terrestrial. That feeling was for God. And even though I didn't know what to, like, I think within moments, I phoned my buddy Chris. He's Chris Peckwin, I'll name. He's the one that's been leading me to Christ for years.
Okay, excellent.
And in the best way possible. He's just, Chris is just a great guy. And the way he does things, his leadership style, is first and foremost by example. But he's a gentle leader. He's firm, but he's a gentle leader. And I'm very honored to call him my best friend, to which Chris would say, well, that's really nice for you, I mean. No, it is said jokingly. But I phoned him, and he starts laughing, and he goes, oh, that was the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't remember the conversation other than him saying that was the Holy Spirit. This is post-Bender. And I remember in that moment when I got off the phone with Chris, I made a promise to God for the first time and meant it. No matter what happens, I will never forget that feeling. And I liken the feeling to when I was like a little kid, and it was the exact same feeling. Like, you know, there's thunder and lightning storm out, and, you know, you're 5 or 6 years old, and you're terrified to stay in your room, so you put your pillow over your face, you run across the hall, and you curl in between mom and dad, and that, oh, I'm safe. It was like that, but it wasn't. It wasn't for my parents. It was for Father God.
And you knew.
I knew.
Just knew.
Well, it was, I want to say instinctual, but it's not. Like, it's not an instinct. It was a definite message. And 48 hours before that, me, God, Christ, really?
And why do you think it was the message, you are safe, reflecting back because on that
would,
now?
It would be, God chose that feeling for the same reason I just told you about feeling safe.
Right, okay. That's because what you needed.
Because it was needed. A parental safeness.
Right.
But it wasn't for my parents.
Right.
I would do one more stint in rehab after that. And it was, I think that was early 21. And then I would go into rehab for like most of 2021. I was in there for like 9 months.
Okay.
Knowing full well that if I had $5 in my pocket, I would immediately run to a liquor store.
Sure, yeah.
But I was PNG'd with my sister, father, wife. Chris called me up and he said, hey, I've been asked and it's been suggested that I put my name forward to run for Conservative Member of Parliament. I didn't even hesitate. I was just like, you're going to win. And I said, how can I help? And he goes, well, done. And I said, do you have a room I can rent? Because I'd be a lot more helpful if I was there with you. And he goes, yeah, I do. He says, when can you move in?
Wow.
And I said, I can be there in about 5 hours.
You know what you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I knew I had to be faithful to the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I was baptized this Easter Sunday, will mark 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, it has been sort of, the most amazing 3 years of my life.
Mm.
I have never been so happy. And I don't mean like walking around smiling. My cousin came out to visit last summer and I had to drive her to some place. Her husband was off doing something else. And she just looked at me and she goes, you're really happy, aren't you?
Hmm.
And I just kind of looked at her and went, yeah, I am. She goes, you can see it in your face. And I go, why was I smiling? She goes, no. And I hate saying this part because I was thinking about how to say it. But I recently started using one of those Christian dating apps. There's not a lot of single women my age in this church. And I took a picture of myself for the profile. And I've never liked looking at myself in a picture. I love this picture of me.
That's excellent.
Because there's a genuine smile on my face.
Yeah.
And I saw what my cousin was meaning.
Oh, that's
like,
nice.
Because I just had a smile. I didn't. No, but I took oh my gosh, take a selfie? Are you kidding? I would like to throat punch people that take selfies. Like you see all these kids, right, you know, like I wouldn't be physically violent, of course, but mm-hmm. you know. And it all started, like, so my baptism, and then I remember like going to church and I said to Pastor Phil, I said, I'm not really feeling welcome here.
Mm-hmm.
And Pastor Phil being Pastor Phil, he didn't like hearing that.
No, I was going to say, how did that affect him?
I mean, it's not offending him, but it's kind of like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I don't really know anybody. And, you know, nobody's sort of extending their hand. Da, 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 da. And he goes, oh. So that's a you thing, not a church thing. Or something like that.
Right.
And I said, well, probably. And he goes, well, you need to start your service work. That was one of the most impactful statements in my life. Because if we go back to 17, joining the military because I've got to serve,
mm-hmm.
there was no sense of fulfillment of service in mm-hmm. that. And it wasn't until Pastor Phil said that I knew why I wasn't happy in the military.
Because
that's not the service that was inside of me.
So you had the calling from a long, long time ago.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, absolutely. And ever since that day, Pastor Phil has been really impactful in my life,
mm-hmm.
right?
getting involved is so key.
It is.
Getting into some sort of service.
Prayer without action is meaningless.
Yeah.
Showing up at church without participating is also meaningless.
Yeah.
And then that just sort of set the ball rolling even faster in my walk with the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Service work. In that service work, I've met so many amazing people.
Mm-hmm.
Every man at our men's night group, not one of them is a jerk. Well, except for maybe Chad. You knew that was coming to me, Chad.
No.
Pastor Phil, if he's listening to this, he's probably laughing at that too for you. Chad's a great guy.
Mm. So what kind of service did you get into? You said here that you are interested
ushering.
In...
What?
Oh, okay.
Well, no, I'm at church. I'm ushering.
Okay, gotcha.
And I'm the 17th most top-rated usher on Yelp.
Okay. I know there's so much in your life that could... you would have this connection with someone who'd gone through PTSD mm-hmm. or depression or alcoholism or any addiction.
There's not too much of an understanding people.
Right. So if that kind of person is listening today,
mm.
is there like a piece of encouragement? I know it would be hard to sum up so much.
You're not going to get through it without the Lord.
Yeah.
You like I no longer go to Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay.
I don't consider myself an alcoholic.
Okay.
And as cliche as it's going to sound, I am fully redeemed in the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need the only problem I have with AA is it never lets you move past the victimhood mentality.
Yeah.
Every time you go,
you become an alcoholic. Yeah.
You become a victim again.
Mm.
And when I stopped going to AA and started going to my men's groups, I would say, if you're in this realm, if you're in the PTSD, first off, you're not going to recognize help when you need it,
mm-hmm.
right? Most people with PTSD don't. It has to be pointed out to them. But even if you're struggling mentally, emotionally, physically, I would highly recommend downloading the Bible Project,
mm-hmm.
the Bible app. And that's how I read my Bible.
Okay.
And I would also encourage you to have a Christian mentor. Someone gentle, someone knowledgeable. I found one. Well, he doesn't know he's my mentor, but he is. Pastor Darryl. Mm. The way he preaches, I just absolutely connected. And Kevin, I don't know your last name. South African Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
He is a mentor mm-hmm. to me, the way he preaches. Find a mentor. Have an hour a day, minimum, with just yourself and the Lord. Watch Christian movies. There's some really good Christian movies out there that there's one called Paul, Apostle of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Caviezel, you've seen it?
Mm-hmm.
It completely changed how I read Corinthians.
Yeah.
And Paul's impact, like, have those Christian heroes. I mean, yes, Christ is our ultimate hero, but there are so many other people.
Yeah.
Bonhoeffer.
And his transformation story.
Yeah. Well, if anybody's been more redeemed right. than Paul, I would challenge you to find one. Yeah. But yeah, people that are struggling, don't stop taking your antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't, like, I'm not saying miracles can't happen. I'm saying that's not how the Lord works always.
Right, yeah.
Because in your own suffering, you will find a greater relationship with the Lord. Because for me,
that's a key right there.
In
your own suffering, you'll find a greater relationship with the Lord. Because we do come through out of suffering, and we can look back on it as, like you said at the beginning, I hope we laugh through this, because that's how it feels to me now.
You've
been redeemed so much, but you can look back on all of that rock bottom situation as, and it would sound weird, almost a blessing to your life that you had been able to experience that and grow from it and come out of it and know what a blessing getting out of that is and the grace of God. And
grace, that's the key word.
It's the key word in all of it, right?
It's grace.
It's his grace.
Like,
it's unfathomable.
And keep your priorities in check.
Yeah.
Material priorities are meaningless.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
10 years ago, if I were to move up to Kelowna, I would have needed 2 53-foot semi-trailers. I had everything. Well, I'm sarcastic, but at least one. And when I moved out here, I fit everything I owned in the back of a VW Touareg.
Yeah.
The Lord had to strip everything away from me. And because I place so much value in possessions.
Mm-hmm.
And I never would have found the Lord had he not taken everything away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, I had the fancy cars.
Mm-hmm.
I had the fancy house. I had a boat, quads, you know, trailer, whole 9 yards. And what was it? Somebody once said, like, take a look around you now. 10 years ago, everything you have now is what you said to yourself 10 years ago would make you happy.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Check
in. Yeah. I'm curious then what Bible verse you brought in to share today.
Ooh, I got two. So my service work, Isaiah 6:8.
Okay, what does it say?
Then the voice of the Lord, or then I heard the voice of the Lord, and he said, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, here am I. Send me.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the macho types co-opt that with military service. Sorry. No.
Didn't do it.
No. Although it could. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like there is that element of society that's needed. I'm not trying to denigrate
right.
anybody's no, service.
Ever. For you. Yeah.
But for me, I even have a tattoo on my arm, actually.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Tattooed verse on his arm.
I don't really actually like any of my tattoos. Sorry, I'm actually quite embarrassed by most of them, except for this one. That I serve my community in different ways, and I'll keep confidential all that I do because it's not me doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Matthew 14:11 or something like that about, you know, you don't go around boasting about your good works. Anyway. But my other Bible verse that I really like, I've been just into it so much, is Genesis 3:15.
Mm-hmm.
And I shall put enmity between you and her, between her offspring and yours. He will crush your head and you will meet his heel. The first reference of Christ in the whole Bible.
Mm.
And I just thought, like, he thought of us, like, not that he ever stopped.
Yeah.
But that was part of the plan from the word go.
Right.
Christ is our indemnity.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that goes back to what the Holy Spirit, that feeling the Holy Spirit gave me on the day I considered myself to be saved. That feeling of safety.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no matter what, for me, Genesis 3:15 lets me know that God has my back. That this has been the plan all along.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are others. I'm not good at remembering stuff all the time. And I know I've had plenty of time to prepare for this, but I've been working for the last 2 weeks.
You know, most people don't come here and quote the verses. They come and read them. So good on you. You did it.
Oh, well, yeah. You got to remember the ones that make an impression. And you know what? Okay. So if you're a new Christian, I want to tell you this. As am I. Like some people call new Christians baby Christians. And it was Pastor Daryl that said, nuh-uh, there's nothing baby about you.
Mm-hmm.
You're very, mature
mm-hmm.
Christian. Well, thank you. But if you're a new Christian, don't be intimidated by people who can quote chapters and verse. Because it's intimidating. And the reason you download the Bible Project is so you can have the voice that reads it. Because there's some words in there. Right?
Yeah.
It's like, what the heck does that say?
Yeah.
You know, later this year, I'll be going to Moldova. There's a couple here, Gary and Darlene.
Yeah.
They just got back from Moldova doing their mission work, and they interrupt human trafficking.
Wow.
And they work with preventing, because Moldova is such an impoverished country
mm-hmm.
that the parents actually sell their children.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And wrap your head around that.
Yeah.
And then I have to be very careful with how I deal with that because, I don't want to get lost mentally like that ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tough work.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I say I'm up for it, but until you're there, anyway.
Yeah.
I will be praying a lot
mm-hmm.
and I will be utilizing all the coping mechanisms that I have available to me. And they're not necessarily internal coping mechanisms. They're my Emmanuel family, my buddies at the men's night, Pastor Daryl, Pastor Phil, Pastor Jeff. There's avenues that I will be able to take.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'll just be going for, I think they call it an orientation trip.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see. Like I'm not... Yeah, I might have to be
that's major.
Behind the scenes.
That's wonderful news, though.
It is.
I mean, that's service, too. That's right in the midst of it.
That's service.
Yeah. into somebody else's darkest place.
I can help them.
Yeah.
I think I've got the tools.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I am going to close this, but what a conversation. And well, thank you very much you. for your courage and being here.
Believe me, I was a little nervous coming in here because I never really sat down with anyone.
Yeah.
Chad's the only one I told. I told Calvin and I told Chris and Karina as I was leaving the door. It's not something I'm looking forward to.
Mm-hmm. I'll just tell the people listening, it's okay. It's okay to come and sit down.
Yeah, it is. Actually,
is it cathartic?
You're very gracious. No. The catharsis is already taking place.
Right, of course it would be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But good. I'm glad it was all right for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm good. Never been happier.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Thanks so much, Nathan.
Thank you.